and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and today I have the distinct pleasure of sitting down with Enverus's very own Chief Product Officer, Jimmy Fortuna. Jimmy's worked his entire career in the tech industry, and while not every stop along the way has been specific to energy, he's always had a deep appreciation for what we all do. I actually learned this firsthand when, just after joining Enverus in 2020, Jimmy created a gamified energy education course that he called the Energy Matrix to force all of us to think hard about what the future of energy might hold. From this exercise, we all either learned or were reminded of a number of things. One, Jimmy could be a professor in his next life. Two, don't always pay attention to what the headlines say. And three, as we all know, always follow the data. We also learned that Jimmy has a passion for nuclear energy and a deeper knowledge about it than most, which we'll get into shortly. So, Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. Glad to be here.
All right. So before we get into the sexiest topic of the day, which will be power, I got a few questions I need to ask you so the audience can get to know you better. All right?
Sure.
All right. So, first question, what is the first concert you ever went to?
Yeah, so that's Beastie Boys' License to Ill in 1986. And if that's not funny enough for the listeners, if you gave me a pad and paper and a few minutes, I could probably still write down the words to most of the lyrics 38 years later. So I guess you could say I listened to it a lot.
Maybe we better check your head, Jimmy. I'm not sure. We'll see.
Exactly.
All right. Next question, beach or mountains? Now, before you answer, I remind you this is a year-round commitment, not seasonal.
Well, it's easy at mountains because I live in them. I live in the Blue Ridge Mountains here in Asheville, North Carolina, and I can see them right out of my window. I wouldn't trade it.
All right. Not gonna argue with you there. Next question, have you been to more countries or states?
Just a few more states. Been to about 30 countries on business mostly, but some pleasure, and in about 35 states.
Got it. And we're not counting layovers and whatnot, right? These are actual visits.
No, this is time. This is time on the ground, actually experiencing the place for what it is. Yeah.
I like it. All right. Next question. What is your favorite color of hydrogen? I'm thinking you might put hydrogen in the category whale oil in terms of how practical it is, but you tell me.
Yeah, so I'm gonna protest the silly hydrogen color schemes, actually. And I think they're just busybody methods of trying to influence how people should think about primary energy sources and maybe even themselves and their own opinions. If we want to talk about hydrogen, we can talk about feedstocks, we can talk about associated emissions, we can talk about cost of production, deliverability. All those things are valid, but not colors. Like, there's more than one scheme in the first place, and in the second place, they're all biased in one way or the other.
Jimmy is passionate about hydrogen. Okay. So, lastly, most importantly, and as far as I'm concerned, what's the best sandwich?
Yeah, so that's actually a something called a cloud sandwich. It o
Okay.
only my lovely spouse Brandy can make them. She only makes them for me. It's plain white bread w spread with mayonnaise and a really fluffy scrambled egg in the middle. And man, you can try to make your own, but you're not going to match hers.
I'm not going to try. That sounds delicious and very special. We'll leave it there. All right, great. Thank you for those answers. I think everyone's got a good sense of who you are now, right? In the most important way. All right. So you've been a tech guy your whole career, sometimes even energy tech. But maybe you could share with the audience a little bit why you're passionate about energy, and then if you have a brief description of what the energy matrix was and how you came to spend so much time thinking about nuclear. Like, why is nuclear your jam?
Sure. Yeah, so I think I'm passionate about energy for a few reasons. And one of them really was a formative childhood experience. I think we can probably all remember that period of time when we're young kids and we kind of view our parents as sort of these superhuman people that can do anything and aren't vulnerable to anything. And it was in that period, I think I might have been in first grade or even kindergarten. I was sitting in a gas line in 1973 with my mom and dad in the car, And I could really detect the real anxiety in them on whether or not they were going to get to the front of the gas line before the gas ran out. And they were hourly workers back in those days. And if they didn't get to work, they didn't get paid. And we were kind of living on the edge, you know. So that anxiety and that vulnerability that they experienced and that I saw really kind of left a mark. And so I got really interested at an early age at what this magical energy stuff was that so concerned my parents and other people. And I grew up during the energy crisis of the 1973 era that started then and kind of ended in the early 80s, 10 years later. So it was always around me. And I think another reason that I'm interested is my mom kind of raised me to be a bit of a humanist. So, thinking about,
Terrible.
yeah, you think thinking about things that made people's lives better and that sort of thing. And so energy has a big impact on that. And we lived a little bit on the distant fringes of the Back to the Land movement in the 1970s, kind of on the outside looking in. These are things like, growing your own food and heating with wood stoves and all kinds of things that people might think of as kind of hippie stuff today.
Like having a
But we,
garden. I feel like having a garden's
yeah,
just
well,
fine.
we heated a lot with wood. We
Yeah.
did grow a fair amount of our own food, and my mom was a real concerned environmentalist. But my dad, every day from that same house, went off to work at one of the largest coal-fired power plants on the eastern seaboard. So, despite dreams perhaps of living off the grid, the reality was we lived in an energy complicated world.
For
And
sure.
so all of those complexities and so on really kind of, kept me engaged throughout my life. And after that and the experience of getting to here to work at Enverus for a long time and learning a lot, I've come to conclude that that without copious supplies of affordable, reliable, and cleaner energy, we're just not going to get those good humanist outcomes that we're looking for. And so I'm interested in doing anything that creates the policies and the conditions that cause that future of abundance and cleanliness to be available. And that's one of the many reasons why I love working here. So
Sure.
so there's that. With regard to the energy matrix, back in 2020, we all of a sudden were grounded. All of our routines were taken away. And we had an odd amount of time to think and reflect about things that we didn't before for a bit. And it, I became concerned that I thought that the discussions about trade-offs between economy, environment, and energy, even within our own population at Enverus, had become oversimplified. Like I think there was almost a thing in the air that said, "Oh, this energy transition thing is it's already a solved. It's a solved problem. All we need to do is have enough public policy support." Maybe a bit more tolerance within the general population for a bit higher energy prices and some time, and this energy transition thing is all good. And as
Yeah.
you know, Andrew, I don't agree with that at all. I think in fact, energy transition is something we've even hardly begun, let alone something that's solved. And I felt like we needed to broaden our perspectives and get more connected to the fundamental, numerate facts about all this stuff, and I think we did that. We broadened some perspectives, and as I look ahead, I think we've come a tremendous distance since my childhood when things were much more polluted, much more
Sure.
expensive. But we've got a long way to go, and that long way to go is why nuclear is my jam.
Okay.
So I've become convinced that if we want to simultaneously provide copious supplies of reliable, affordable energy, and we also want to decarbonize, that I just don't see a future of accomplishing that combination of things without a large build out of nuclear power beyond, well beyond what the world has today. I've seen no numerate plan that is credible to the contrary, or any policy framework that's credible to the contrary. So that's why I'm interested in it.
All right. Very, very thorough answer. Thank you. Would expect
Sure.
nothing less. We'll jump into that nuclear part in a second. So What I'd love to hear now a little bit from your point of view is what's going on in power right now? Two decades of no growth, suddenly we're growing at something like 3.6% this year in demand. What's driving that growth? And if it is AI, tell us why it's not a flash in the pan, or if it is a flash in the pan, and how we should kind of think about this power demand growth going forward.
Sure. Well, what I think we're hearing, both from our customers and as well as from broader sources, is that data center buildouts generally and AI specifically are a big driver. And I think there's lots of quantitative things that you can use to back up that view. That's a pretty easy case to make. I think another one that was present prior to the data center and AI bubble starting to get so much attention was the electrification of the end use of energy, which is something that has been proceeding, up and to the right ever since we've had electricity. It continues, and I think a lot of folks concerned about energy transition want that to inflect even further. But it continues no matter what, and so that means more electricity at the point of end use. I think reshoring of manufacturing is one we keep hearing about. I personally would love to see a lot more quantitative information on that. Like, I know we're breaking ground on a lot of facilities, and I hear a lot of statistics around that. I'd love to see more numbers about what that reshoring is actually causing to happen from an electric power perspective. And I think a fourth and final one, which is not insignificant, is I think we've reached the end of the road for some of the easy efficiency gains, I'm going to call it, that have been undertaken since my childhood during that energy crisis. Like, I don't think people realize just how much more energy intensive our lives were back then compared to the benefit we got from it. Like, the efficiency of automobiles, of appliances, of lighting, all those kinds of things, they use a lot less primary energy for the benefit that they used to give us. But most of those gains, the easy stuff, have been, wrung out of the system over the past 50 years. And now that that's happened, growth in GDP and population are now again causing demand to grow. So I think it's all four of those things.
We changed all the light bulbs. The cars aren't getting any more fuel efficient,
Energy Star
and
appliances,
all
heat.
the whole nine, better
Yeah.
windows, insulation, all that kind of stuff, and
Sure.
regulations. Okay, all right. So, power demand growth is coming, without a doubt. So, how do you? Yeah.
AI, you mentioned a little bit too.
Okay.
I wanted to bring back to that for a second. It is not a flash in the pan, in my view. It is, in fact, I believe, the most important technology that humans have brought forward since fire. And I realize that's a big sweeping statement, but I stand to it. Humans changed their trajectory and, in fact, became human when we started learning how to use fire and building it for ourselves. And that was the utilization of energy outside of our own bodies, was really the fundamental thing that happened there. We are now, with artificial intelligence, beginning to leverage intelligence outside of our own bodies. And that is a development that is very difficult to overstate in its significance.
I
So,
remember talking to you like, oh, sorry, go ahead.
yeah, I mean, think of it this way. Imagine that you're in a Victorian parlor somewhere in the 1880s, and somebody walks in and does this wacky experiment where you've got a compass and there's this thing called a battery and there's a coil of wire, and you close the circuit and the compass needle points somewhere else instead of pointing to the north. And everybody kind of claps and cheers and goes, "Oh, that's pretty cool." And everybody's looking for the invisible force that's moving the needle, and nobody can find it. And it's, blah blah blah. And then, immediately thereafter, they go back to talking about, what's going on in, the rest of the empire in India, and they forget they ever saw the thing. All of us right now. We're those people in that parlor that have seen this little magic trick and we don't really understand it. And the world is going to change about as much as electricity caused after that vignette. It's that big of a deal.
You told me we were talking like 7 or 8 months ago, and we were talking about Gen AI, and I was like, I guess I got to start learning about this Gen AI thing and what it means. And you said something to the effect of, I haven't seen technology like this since Netscape. And I thought for a minute, I was like, you mean the internet? And you said yes. And to me, that was the moment where I was like, okay, if this is going to be as impactful, we got to start figuring it out. So, one of the things we did figure out is it's going to take a lot of power, and we're going to need a lot more energy to drive this tech along with the other things that we talked about. And so, here in North America, how do you see utilities scrambling to meet it? And if they're not, what should they be doing differently?
Well, I'm not sure that they are scrambling to meet it. So, if I think back to about a year ago, right now, actually, I sat in the audience with hundreds of people while Microsoft's Director of Nuclear and Energy Innovation made a presentation to the audience, saying, more or less, the utilities that we interact with are telling us they simply cannot serve our future load projections. And he was talking about that on the basis of their AI book alone, let alone just other data centers. And so, there's a lot of information in that statement. Like, so first of all, why does Microsoft even have a director of nuclear and energy innovation in the first place? What does that tell you?
Because Bill Gates, he wrote the book about the nuclear. Maybe there's some influence. I don't know.
It
Anyway,
could be. I mean, it could
could
be.
be.
They did hire the gentleman away from the Tennessee Valley Authority where he ran nuclear reactors. So, there's that.
All right.
But in any case, the fact that they're being told that utilities can't serve their load is pretty meaningful. And in terms of what utilities could be doing differently, there's a ton of stuff. One thing that caught my eye a couple weeks ago was an announcement made right here in my home state of North Carolina, where Duke, our regulated monopoly that provides electricity, did an announcement with all the usual suspects, AWS, Google, Amazon, Microsoft. And essentially, the gist of the announcement, as I think we understand it, is that they're working together to create more generation and other grid resources that aren't necessarily rate-based into all of the ratepayers' bills, which, as one of their ratepayers, I greatly appreciate. But I think the idea is they want to unlock the ability of Duke to create more resources to serve their demand, and they're willing to fund it, which I think is a very interesting development and one that might be leveraged by other utilities too. Apart from that,
Prepay, basically prepay for power 5 years from now, and so you don't have to pay for it, the consumer, and Amazon and Microsoft will get it later.
Right, I think that's right, and another thing I could say is that I think utilities need to do a much better job of advocating for rational energy policies as relates to electricity. I mean, just look at what the regulators are telling us. Listen to what NERC and FERC are saying about the picture of future reliability of electric power in the United States. Or put yourself in the shoes of a ratepayer in California who's already paying through the nose and is getting set to pay a lot more. Or look at a big load like Microsoft not being able to get what they need to expand. It's not a great picture. Our
Right.
policy framework needs work, and I think they should advocate for it.
So I guess one of the other questions that I get asked a lot or we discuss is around the major tech companies, but also the oil and gas companies who are seeing power demand increase in areas where there's no load. Are the corporates just going to take it on themselves and put it behind the meter? Does that make sense? Or do they really need to invest alongside the utilities to meet this growing demand in your view?
It's a good open question. I mean, I learned not long ago that large industrial sources of demand actually used to serve their own load as a norm until sometime shortly after the First World War, and then it became, they were kind of pulled into the grid, if you will. So it's not like they've not served themselves before. I think that's a possibility. It seems to me a more likely, faster, nearer term thing would be to see potentially more arrangements like we saw between Talen and AWS. That was, I think that was like a month or two ago, where AWS bought that data center campus and I think a commitment for 480 megawatts from one of the reactors there. We're doing some work on research on this sort of arrangement right now and trying to imagine, like how many more of those could be done. I mean, there are 92 nuclear power plants in the United States. If these big data center loads want more juice and not carbon, seems like there could be a real possibility of more of those things happening.
Sounds terrible for the consumer, Jimmy. That sounds and the reliability of for the rest of us of the grid.
Well, it certainly has implications, but I don't think all of them are bad. If we can in fact reliably remonetize valuable baseload generation, especially nuclear, I think we possibly make that form of power bankable again, or more bankable than it is today, because you've got really long-term, high-value contracts with blue-chip names that are saying we'll buy that power. There it's not all bad, not by any means. So I would note, by the way, that the data center folks can do that a lot faster than other heavy manufacturers because if you're building things or you're milling or mining things, you've got to move lots of people and material around. You've got infrastructure, all kinds of stuff. Data centers don't have to worry about that. They just need power and bits, so they can do those kind of arrangements a lot faster.
Got it. All right. Well, so as we continue to think about where this supply is going to come from, obviously we're here to talk about nuclear, and when you talk to people in general, it's much more topical as a supply source. But you get a lot of yeah, it's never going to happen. Yeah, regulation. Yeah, this, right? But then you see, like I mentioned before, Bill Gates invested $1 billion in TerraPower, and you see companies that are building microreactors. You saw Diamondback announce the JV with Oklo for a facility in the or in the Permian. I think the team's tracking like 12 projects that we expect to be online by the end of the decade. And so is there a reason to be optimistic we might find ourselves with some new baseload carbon-free energy in the future here in North America?
Yeah, I do think there's reason to be optimistic. And as for the, it'll never happen crowd, I would encourage them to learn a little history perhaps before they say very much. To a meaningful degree, nuclear already has happened. So let's just look at some base level statistics. It's 18% of electricity supply in the United States today. If you add hydro, by the way, for another six, you're looking at nearly a quarter of all the United States electric supply is baseload carbon free now. And it has been for a while. There's other things going on, of course, too. Like look at my home state of North Carolina. We're 33% today. So we're well ahead of the national average. The next door state that I grew up in South Carolina, is 55% on a bad day. Those are approaching Ontario type numbers, or and could be headed toward France type numbers. I would also point out South Carolina's got some of the lowest electricity rates in the country. So this idea that nuclear is has been always will be too expensive is just factually false. So I do think that if we're really serious about decarbonizing, and we want to be able to have reliable baseload, it's not only doable, it's already been done. I would also point out that if you look at baseload adds to the United States in 2024, it's almost entirely nuclear, just on the addition of Vogtle 4. And that's good, but the cloud in that silver lining is nobody's building any other baseload. So
Everything's renewable, right?
yeah, you got a lot of wind and you got a lot of solar, and if you look at it's 92% of the new generation this year, in fact. And notice I say generation. Like some people are pointing at storage and looking at that number. Storage is fine. Storage is not generation. So 92% of new generation is wind and solar, and that's definitely not baseload. So at the same time, I think everybody's rediscovering the value of baseload, and so I think I think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. There's 400 operating reactors in the world today. There's
Okay.
about 58 more under construction. Now that Vogtle 3 and 4 are operational, where else are we getting built? Well, Bangladesh. Yep. Egypt. Yes. Turkey. Yes. So I would like somebody to explain to me how it is that something that can and is happening in those three countries can't happen here.
And these are
With
large, these are your traditional large reactor, not one of the new technologies, right?
Yeah, that's right. They're traditional light water reactor technologies, typically PWR, pressurized water reactors, boiling water reactors. They use low enriched uranium fuels. It's the stuff that we've got 70 years of operating experience with,
Sure.
and that's what's getting built.
Well, so okay, so this so that's sort of exciting that they're being built somewhere, but and the conversations leading to more discussion around the potential for different options here. But one of the other I guess challenges people flag are regulatory issues. Are there regulatory issues? In the energy industry, regulatory sounds like a bad word, or generally is. Is anything changing, or you see anything changing that would be supportive to advancing some of these either new technologies or just the ability to get nuclear power on the grid?
Yes. Okay. So, first, with regard to regulatory hurdles on nuclear, there's a lot of mythology around this, and it's understandable because there are real nuclear regulatory problems for sure. But I don't think when you do a cold, hard, objective examination of what's really been stopping nuclear in the past 20 years, it's not regulatory really. Like you can point to plenty of combined operating license capacities that have been approved by the NRC, but just not built, where the applicants withdrew the applications. And there are some that are still active and ready to be built, but they're not getting built because, again, nobody's building baseload. Nuclear is the hardest baseload to build, and if nobody's building baseload, why are they going to start with that? Now, that being said, I want to repeat, there are definitely things that could be done better in nuclear regulation. We don't have time to talk about them, but I don't think they're the enemy number one of nuclear expansion. I would say the fact that our energy markets don't value baseload electricity is the most significant problem. And then after that, I think there are other things that are regulatory adjacent, which are, if you look at the litigation, for example, that happened for the against the Mountain Valley Pipeline, took a 3-year project, made it a 10-year project. If you're somebody highly motivated to prevent something from getting built in this country, you can use lawyers to prevent it, and that's I think a big problem.
What about the idea of the spent fuel being a dangerous, a big problem, one of the reasons we don't want to continue to build out nuclear? Is that a NIMBY thing, or is there some real danger people should be worried about?
Yeah, I think spent fuel is controversial because people just don't know about it. It's very poorly understood. So, and that understanding, frankly, is sometimes fueled by NGOs that have an anti-nuclear sentiment. When you look at spent fuel, it contains two things that you might be concerned with. Okay? One is called fission products, and the other is transuranic elements. So, take these two things separately. Fission products are the really scary things from a life, health, safety perspective. Honestly, so when you pull that fuel bundle out of a reactor when it's time to take it out, it's those things are so white hot in terms of radiation that if you were standing close to one of those fuel rods, you would receive a lethal dose in about 6 seconds. This stuff is super highly radioactive when it first comes out of the reactor. What they do is they take it out of the reactor and they put it in what looks like a gigantic swimming pool. And they let it sit there for years. And the reason why is water is an amazingly good nuclear radiation shield. So it sits there in the water, and these very energetic fission products decay very rapidly. So, after just a few years, the danger level plummets. And after that, they take the bundle and they put it in something called a dry cask, and then they let it sit indefinitely. And that's okay. That's actually fine. The other things that are in there are transuranics. These are elements heavier than uranium. So think like americium, plutonium, etc. they last a much longer time, like geologic timescales, hundreds of thousands of years.
Okay.
But the energy level, the radiation level that comes from them is much, much, much lower than the fission products. So in order to be harmed by those things, you'd pretty much have to ingest them. You'd have to breathe them in or you'd have to eat them. And what anti-nuclear activists do is they conflate those two things. You know, this very low risk thing that lasts forever, and this high risk thing that only lasts, you know, a few decades, put them together and make it sound like this incredibly dangerous stuff lasts forever. And that's just not true. So it leads to bad policy, honestly.
Well, okay, so we're coming up on time, but I sort of want to bring it together here. As I continue to learn more about power in general and the demands and what's pushing it forward, and then how our grid is built, and the need for baseload to balance intermittent sources, and nuclear comes back into the discussion, and it seems like just debunking some of the myths is what's needed to move some of this forward, whether it's, you know, dependent, no matter what size, whether it's a microreactor to a new Vogtle 5, 6, right? And so I guess the question for you here at the end is, how optimistic are you that this is something that is going to happen either near, medium, or long term as we try and solve our power demand growth challenges?
Yeah, I'm reasonably optimistic. I'm not so sure about time frames or exactly what moves first. I think if these data center nuclear hookups happen, that could actually change the policy game. It could change public sentiment's already ahead of policy. You know, there's good numbers on that. We didn't talk about microreactors and SMR type reactors much, but there's 100 reactor startups that we're tracking in our research. Mm-hmm. And one of the really big exciting things about those is being able to directly decarbonize very hard to decarbonize thermal loads that are not electric power, right?
Right.
Those new innovative reactor startup type companies are building designs that are well targeted at that problem, which traditional reactors are less targeted at and less effective for. And so I'm optimistic about that as well. It's just really sensible. It's a great way to use the technology. And I think what we need to move things forward, Andrew, is a few things. We need a healthy supply chain and services chain that has got a relatively steady workload that keeps it busy and keeps it active, not something that turns on and off every, you know, 20 years. So we need that. We need that kind of supply flow. I really keep coming back to this thing. I think we need reformed electricity markets, like the stuff that we created in the 2000s timeframe. It's just terrible. It's very bad for creating the right kind of long-term investment scheme. So, you know, if we can get those two things, I think we've got a bright future for nuclear build out and reduction of carbon.
Sounds good to me. All right. Well, look, we're at time here. Jimmy, thank you so much. Really appreciate the insights. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll get to your questions in a follow-up manner. But, thanks again. And we'll look forward to seeing everyone next time. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.